And now it is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use is brought to you every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy because there might be some information that you really want to have access to later. And that means names, addresses, web pages, phone numbers, you know, times, dates, you name it. You might want to check this all out. So I'll give you a second to find that pencil and paper before we get right in to announcements. Coming up is the Earth First Climbers Camp. It's going to be starting in a week or so up in Minnesota, Wisconsin area, upper Midwest. The actual date's June 16th through the 22nd for the Earth First Climbers Guild Climbing Camp. Attendees will learn everything from the basics of ascending and descending a rope to setting anchors and more advanced skills like platform rigging and creating pod structures. All that's left then is to use these skills to stop the corporate ecocycle monster from destroying your bioregion. This is really important stuff to learn. And what you ought to bring is stuff that you'd pack like you were going camping: a sleeping bag, tent, rain gear, appropriate clothing for southern Minnesota in June. It might be a little warm and a little buggy. I would say a whole lot buggy. You'll need some good climbing shoes. These are any shoe with a stiff sole. Sandals don't hack it, and barefoot, absolutely not. Gloves, bike gloves are great, but anything snug and flexible will work. Don't get blisters. Pants that you can climb and be comfortable in, that means loose or stretchy and breathable material, and somewhat sturdy, too. Trees can be rough. If you have your own climbing gear, bring that along. It's certainly not required. We should have plenty of communal gear to share, so no need to worry if you don't have your own. But if you do, please bring it along. Also, bring food. Not all Earth First Climbing Guild camps have communal kitchens. However, this one will. So bring food to donate to the kitchen. Keep in mind there will be vegans, so leave that half side of beef for the homeless shelter. Bring what you need to sustain yourself for a week. If you need your chocolate every day, you better bring that. It's not going to be at the communal kitchen. And you should bring some money, about $25 to $50 for the week. If you don't have any money, they won't turn you away, but everything takes money to run. So bring some things in the way of cash. Don't bring your dog, don't bring your drugs, and don't bring your bad attitude. Dogs, they just don't work at a climbing camp. Drugs, you got to have your head together to be a good climber. And nobody wants a bad attitude around. Everybody's trying to be safe, learn something new, and helps to be supportive. What the camp will provide are knowledgeable trainers, climbing gear. Once again, have no fear. If you don't have your own gear, they'll have it. And they will have a full kitchen serving three meals a day. And we will have more details, directions, and a training schedule at efclimbers.net. That's efclimbers.net. Coming up July 1st through the July 7th is the 2014 Earth First Round River Rendezvous, taking place somewhere in Northern California, Southern Oregon. It's going to be held in Southern Cascadia in the Klamath Knot area. There's been a couple of locations that they're checking out, but nothing has firmed up yet. It is a critical time for the movement in the Pacific Northwest. The coal and oil companies are trying to use the Columbia River to transport fossil fuels abroad, ship in gargantuan earth-destroying machinery to fire up Alberta tar sands, and none of that's good. In the far reaches of southern Cascadia, the road builders are clearing ancient oak trees and draining the wetlands of Little Lake Valley near... Oh, come on. Willits. That's the place. All in the name of convenience. Again, Caltrans wants to expand a bunch of highways, and all of that has to come from our trees and wildlands. And as always, from the Redwood Coast to the Cascades, chainsaws are threatening to destroy the fragile biodiversity of our region's forests. Yet in the spirit of Cascadia, we are fighting back, sitting in trees, blocking roads, marching in the streets, howling in the offices and courtrooms, and standing in solidarity with our friends who are fighting for their indigenous lands. Come for the rendezvous week, stay for the Cascadian summer, and plug into all our regional campaigns. With respect to the enormous span of our region, the 2014 Round River Rendezvous will be hosted by a coalition of activists hailing from multiple hometowns and biocentric organizations. Our scouting team is out and about. Like I say, they've looked at a couple of places. We don't know which one it's going to be yet. There are 11 wilderness areas and amazing diversities of endemic plant species. The Southern Cascades, the Sierra Nevada, the Coast Range, the Volcanics, you name it, it's out there. And the Lone Wolf OR7, his mate and puppies. We'll tell you about that in a minute. So go to www.2014rrr.org. That's 2014rrr.org, and get the latest news about the 2014 Earth First Round River Rendezvous, July 1st through July 7th. Uncle Dennis will be there. The California Fish and Game Commission has voted to add the gray wolf to the state endangered species list. The California Fish and Game Commission has voted to move forward a listing of the gray wolf as an endangered species under California law. The vote took place a couple of days ago at the regularly scheduled commission meeting in Fortuna. Commissioners Richard Rogers, Jack Bayless, and Michael Sutton voted for the listing, while Commissioner Jacques Hosler-Camassin voted no. Boo hiss. Commissioner Jim Kellogg was not present. "No land animal is more iconic in the American West than the gray wolf," said Michael Sutton, who was also president of the commission. "Wolves deserve our protection as they begin to disperse from Oregon to their new historic range in California." The regulatory language will take several months to complete and approve. However, the decision provides permanent protection for the gray wolf and immediate protection under the California Endangered Species Act. That protection will remain in place throughout the required regulatory process. The gray wolf is already federally listed as an endangered species and is therefore protected by the Federal Endangered Species Act in California. The federal act makes it unlawful to take any listed wildlife unless permitted by regulation. The term "take" means to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, collect, capture, or attempt to engage in any such conduct. The protection provided under federal law overlaps but does not supersede protection provided by listing under California law. At this time, there are no gray wolves known to be in California. A male wolf that originated in southeastern Oregon, known as OR7, has crossed the Oregon-California border several times since December of 2011. But at this time, OR7 is in southwestern Oregon, where he has found a mate. And on Monday, biologists from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife have photographs of two wolf puppies in the vicinity. So there is a wolf pack in southwestern Oregon. If you want more information about gray wolves, including where OR7 traveled in California, please visit www.dfg.ca.gov. That's www.dfg.ca.gov. And find your way to the wolf page. It's not that hard. Unfortunately, the fracking moratorium bill in California has failed in the Senate. This story by Catherine Phillips of the Sierra Club. Despite a strong push by a broad coalition that included environmentalists, environmental justice groups, labor unions, business interests, tribal organizations, and health organizations, Senate Bill 1132, the fracking moratorium bill, has failed to clear the Senate. The bill faced strong opposition from the oil industry during its first vote on the Senate floor. The bill earned 18 votes, coming up 3 votes short of passage. And the votes didn't get better after that, it just got worse. In the last several months, a number of reports have noted the oil industry had spent about $15 million in the state legislature in the last 15 months. That's $1 million a month, including blocking efforts to halt fracking and acid stimulation. Such generous spending, combined with a late-hour decision by the California Building Trades Council to oppose Senate Bill 1132, produced high hurdles for the bill's passage. Other labor organizations devoted to public health and a sustainable economy in California, including the SEIU State Council and the Communication Workers of America, helped lobby to pass the bill out of the Senate. Unfortunately, their efforts, plus the efforts of our broad coalition and grassroots networks, weren't enough to counter the building trades and the oil industry. However, the loss in the Senate was not unexpected, and the bill produced a number of benefits. The moratorium bill drew statewide and national attention to fracking debates in California and nationwide, helped to develop a broad coalition of supporters for pausing fracking in the state, and helped increase public support for a moratorium. Polling released last week, just before the Senate vote, showed that 68% of voters in California support a statewide moratorium. The bill also helped to unify and organize environmental voices on the fracking issue. Many of those organizations, including the Sierra Club, have helped develop local moratoria and ban initiatives around the state. Sierra Club California's fracking campaign will now turn more attention to other tools in the fight to halt dangerous fracking and acid well stimulation in California, including the local initiatives, the press to persuade the governor to use his administrative tools to pause fracking, and, of course, the ever popular legal actions. Notably, all of these efforts send a signal to investors that California is not a safe place to bet on big dollar returns from fracking operations. It's much safer and smarter to invest in California's clean energy industry. If you want more information about this, you may go to www.sierraclub.org. That's www.sierraclub.org. And down in Australia, the Maules Creek blockade has outed some snitches for hire. In this story by Tom Allard of The Age, as found on the Earth First Newswire, former soldiers and intelligence operatives have been sent to infiltrate a network of anti-coal protesters aiming to thwart a multi-billion dollar expansion of coal production in northern New South Wales, Australia. Using false identities, the spies for hire have attempted to penetrate the inner sanctum of a group of environmentalists and local landowners who have vigorously attempted to stop the coal mines at Maules Creek and Bogabri. In what represents a significant escalation of a heated battle between Whitehaven Coal and Idemitsu Australia Resources and anti-coal activists, a Fairfax Media investigation has uncovered a clandestine campaign of significant scale but ham-fisted execution. Several undercover agents were discovered by the activists, included one alleged spy, Marnie Tissot, who was confronted on camera. The operation raises questions of its legality given the outright deception to disrupt protest movements. Fairfax has interviewed individuals directly involved in the espionage and multiple sources with detailed inside information of the surveillance have independently alleged it was orchestrated by a company run by a former Australian military intelligence officer, Tony Groves, and his partner, Maria Topia. While their firm, the Center for Intelligence and Risk Management, had direct operational responsibility for the espionage, it is only one link in a chain of companies believed to be involved. Who the ultimate client was remains a mystery. Spies in the field were not told, although it was clear the Center for Intelligence and Risk Management was acting for another party or parties. The intelligence operatives' task was to get information on protest actions, report on actions, and gather information on leadership, said one source. Some were tasked to infiltrate, others just to do observation. Miss Topia is from New Zealand, is believed to have an intelligence background, and is the owner of CIRM. Mr. Groves is a former member of the Australian Defence Force who has worked as a private security guard in Afghanistan and Iraq. The two are believed to be in a personal relationship. Ms. Topia and Mr. Groves turned up at Maules Creek under assumed identities, said protest leader Ben Solity. Mr. Groves said he was a former member of a bikers club who had previous weapons charges on the books and made several visits. Tony brought a partner named Maria to the camp once with a couple of other friends. That Maria is the same person that is pictured in Maria Topia's Facebook profile, said Mr. Solity. The protesters were already deeply worried about infiltration when they confronted Marnie Tissot in May. Ms. Tissot had visited the camp on four occasions under the alias Lulu Mayfield, even acting as a spokeswoman at one point. Her suspicious behavior and the inadvertent revealing of her real name in an email she sent led to the discovery that she worked for Professional Service Solutions, a Brisbane intelligence and security firm that has worked for the United Nations. Confronted on camera, she denied she was working undercover, then broke down in tears and said she had assumed a false identity to escape the attention of a violent ex-husband. She also said she had stopped working for PSS. However, Miss Tissot continued to use her real name once she left Maules Creek and returned quickly back to work at PSS after being outed. Mr. Solity said the campaign at Maules Creek was to, quote, raise awareness about the destruction of the Leard State Forest for a mine, which will inevitably contribute to a large amount of carbon emissions that will exacerbate climate change. And if you want to see the pictures of all three of these infiltrators, go to the Earth First Newswire, and pictures of them are posted along with additional details on this story. And the Pebble Mine Company has sued the Environmental Protection Agency for safeguarding salmon in this story from the Environment News Service. The Pebble Limited Partnership has sued the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for taking the first step in a public process that may lead to advanced protections for Bristol Bay, which hosts the world's largest runs of salmon. The EPA's advanced protections would prevent the waste from a massive proposed gold, copper, and molybdenum open pit mine in the Bristol Bay watershed from damaging the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery and the local communities that depend on the bay's abundant fish. Wholly owned by the Vancouver, British Columbia-based company Northern Dynasty Minerals Limited, the Pebble Limited Partnership has filed suit in U.S. District Court for Alaska, seeking an injunction to, quote, stop the EPA's process to preemptively veto the Pebble Project, unquote, under Section 404C of the U.S. Clean Water Act. The Pebble Project is located 200 miles southwest of Anchorage on state land designated for mineral exploration and development. It is situated in a tundra region 1,000 feet above sea level and 65 miles from Cook Inlet, which flows into Bristol Bay. In its complaint, Pebble Limited Partnership asserts that in the absence of a permit application, EPA's action exceeds its authority under the Clean Water Act and is contrary to the Alaska Statehood Act, the Cook Inlet Exchange legislation, and other federal law. Pebble Limited Partnership CEO Tom Collier said, quote, simply put, EPA has repeatedly ignored detailed comments that we, the state of Alaska, and others have made about this massive federal overreach and continues to advance an unprecedented preemptive regulatory action against the Pebble Project that vastly exceeds its Clean Water Act authority. If EPA ultimately vetoes Pebble before the development plan is proposed or evaluated, through a comprehensive federal or state permitting processes the president established will have significant long-term effects on business investment in this state and throughout the country. Litigation is necessary in order to get the agency's attention and bring some rational perspective back to the U.S. permitting process. While we would prefer to avoid this lawsuit, we are fully prepared to defend ourselves against the precedent-setting unlawful actions of this agency, unquote, said Collier. Continuing, our legal action does not in any way seek to diminish EPA's legitimate role under the Clean Water Act or its right to participate as a regulatory agency within the Clean Water Act permitting process, including a comprehensive review under the Environmental Protection Act, he said. Further, EPA has exceeded its statutory authority and violated federal law by preventing Alaska from exercising its rights under the Alaska Statehood Act to determine the best way to manage state lands to benefit the people of Alaska, said Collier. Continuing, we are urging EPA to immediately stop its preemptive action against Pebble and the state of Alaska. The public interest environmental law firm Earth Justice has denounced the lawsuit. Tom Waldo, Earth Justice attorney based in Juneau, Alaska, said, EPA has both the science and the law behind it. The Environmental Protection Agency's comprehensive analysis, which it prepared with extensive public input and peer review, showed that the pebble mine would be unacceptable for the wild salmon of Bristol Bay and the many people who depend on the $1 billion fishing industry, the largest sockeye fishery in the world. Pebble could learn a lot from the Environmental Protection Agency by disclosing its plans to the public and conducting a transparent process. Unquote. Underwater horrors, shells of marine life are melting off the coast of the United States in this story by Jeremy Hance of Manga Bay, as found on the Earth First Newswire. It could be the plot of a horror movie. Humans wake up one day only to discover that chemical changes in the atmosphere are dissolving away parts of their body. But for small marine life known as sea butterflies or pteropods, that's what's happening off the west coast of the United States. Increased carbon in the ocean is melting away the shells of sea butterflies, which are tiny marine snails that underpin much of the ocean's food chain, including prey for pink salmon, mackerel, and herring. We did not expect to see pteropods being affected to this extent in our coastal region for several decades, said William Peterson, Ph.D., an oceanographer at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The current acidification of the ocean is occurring at a faster rate than any time in the past 50 million years. Sampling sea butterflies in the species Limacina helicina off California, Washington, and Oregon in the summer of 2011, researchers found that over 50% of onshore sea butterflies suffered from severe dissolution damage, according to the paper. Offshore, 24% of individuals showed such damage. The shells of sea butterflies are dissolving due to increased acidification of the oceans caused by society's carbon dioxide emissions. While emissions from burning coal, gas, and oil are pumped into the atmosphere, the oceans eventually soak up about a third of the cumulative emissions. This increase in carbon dioxide in the oceans leads to a decrease in the availability of calcium carbonate and its crystal form aragonite, which sea crustaceans, mollusks, and some plant butterflies use to make their shells. While many other key species require calcium carbonate, such as corals, crustaceans, mollusks, and some plankton species. The extent of ocean acidification varies across regions, depths, and seasons, but it is particularly acute where seasonal upwellings occur. This is when deep cold water is pushed to the surface, a phenomenon that further depletes aragonite. In fact, the worst of the impacts were seen off the coast of California, where low aragonite levels had increased sixfold to the top 100 meters of the water column. Limacina helicina from onshore regions showed dissolution that was evenly spread over entire surface of shells, while in offshore regions only the first whorl showing evidence of dissolution. This suggests that less corrosive offshore conditions only affected pteropods during early stages, while prolonged exposure to more severe undersaturated conditions in onshore regions resulted in dissolution covering the whole shell, wrote the scientists. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, and the result of massive influxes of carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels, the researchers estimated that around 20% of sea butterflies would have seen some shell dissolution. Today's percentage is more than twice that, 53% near the coastline, and the scientists predict that 70% of sea butterflies will be impacted in the region by 2050. Acidification of our oceans may impact marine ecosystems in a way that threatens the sustainability of marine resources we depend on, said Libby Jewett, director of NOAA Ocean Acidification Program. Research on the progression and impacts of ocean acidification is vital to understanding the consequences of our burning fossil fuels. This is not the first time scientists have found evidence of worsening ocean acidification dissolving shells of sea butterflies. 2 years ago, researchers reported that they discovered sea butterflies of the same species, Limacina helicina, were losing their shells in Antarctica's southern ocean. The snails do not necessarily die as a result of their shells dissolving. However, it may increase their vulnerability to predation and infection, consequently having an impact to other parts of the food web, lead author Geraint Tarling of the British Antarctic Survey said in 2012. In fact, the most recent paper notes that the shell is key to sea butterfly reproduction. The shell is of particular importance during the reproductive stage when the sperm are exchanged between individuals and need to be stored before fertilizing an egg. Since sea butterflies provide a food source for many species of fish, scientists say their decline could hurt all sorts of marine animals, including whales and songbirds. And loopholes in protection decision will hurt lesser prairie chickens in this biological diversity story. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has decided to protect highly imperiled lesser prairie chickens only as threatened rather than endangered, putting in place special exemptions that would allow the destruction of many of these strutting grouse-like birds and their dwindling grassland habitat. The service has increasingly used the Act Section 4D to create loopholes that allow continued habitat destruction and harm to the species. In the case of prairie chickens, the service also endorsed a deal that would allow the oil and gas industry alone to kill the equivalent of nearly half the remaining birds in the next 10 years. Drought and habitat destruction are devastating the small remaining population of this magnificent grassland bird, said Jay Linninger, senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. The state-level plans and voluntary measures will not get traction fast enough to prevent extinction. And you can check out this story and many others at www.biologicaldiversity.org. That's www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news on this week's Earth First Update. Tune back in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another edition of the Earth First Update. Or you could tune in tomorrow and listen to this edition of the Earth First Update rebroadcast at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. Or next Monday night at 9:30, you could tune in to KRFP Radio Free Moscow, Idaho on 90.3 FM, their high power frequency, and hear the Earth First Update. If you don't have access to either of those, you can go to the website www.radioforall.net. and search for Earth First Radio News. Don't forget the exclamation point or the Earth First Update. That's radioforall.net. Radio, the number, forall.net. And Uncle Dennis would like to ask you to support radioforall.net as a archive of locally and independently produced radio programs for the last 20 years. Radioforall.net has been an invaluable resource for pirate and independent radio stations, and they need your help. They're running out of money. They need to get some new equipment, so go to radioforall.net and support them. The Earth First Update is a production of the Earth First Radio News and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.